Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 1 minute after 9 a.m., January 31st, 2020. I'd like to remind everybody to kind of silence their cell phones, especially the ones from the public. Kind of galleries are kind of empty. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop, Senator Olson, and Senator Wilkowski. We have Senator Hoffman and Senator Wilson will not be joining us today. They have other engagements, and we are being joined by Senate President Giesel. Today we have one item on the work list, and that is we're going to talk about the permanent fund. We have 40 slides to go through, plus we'll have some dialogue, so we'll try to clip along. We have floor at 10:30, correct? So we got an hour and a half, so we want to try to get through it if at all possible. So with us today is Ms. Angela Rodel, Chief Executive Officer. She can come forward, and she wants to kind of give the public at home that is watching a little bit of background on herself. We're very familiar with her here at the table over the years. And then she's going to briefly introduce some support staff she has that the public would be interested in knowing a little bit. And then she'll take us through the presentation, and we'll follow the standard format of questions at the end of the slides. Go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Angela Rodel. I am the Chief Executive Officer for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. I have been with the corporation in this role since October of 2015, so almost 4.5 years. Prior to that, I served as a trustee to the fund as the Commissioner of Revenue, and so I've been in Alaska now since 2011. Time flies when you're having this much fun. I'd also like to take a moment, if I may, Mr. Chairman, to introduce some members of my staff. This is a first, and I'm really excited to bring them along because we talk a lot, and you'll hear a lot about what we're doing, and so to see some of the faces that are doing it. So behind me, we have our Chief Investment Officer, Marcus Frampton. He was named Chief Investment Officer in September of 2018, so he has served in the role slightly over a year. Prior to that, he was Director for Private Income and Infrastructure and Income Opportunities. He has been with the corporation since 2012, and he has won numerous awards. He's one of the people I like to brag on with the additional staff. And I am also pleased to introduce our Chief Risk Officer, Sebastian Vadakamchuri. He joined us also in October of 2018, and he came to us after 20 plus years at the GCC, the Gulf Investment Corp for the Gulf States in Kuwait City. So we were really excited to be able to bring him on as our Chief Risk Officer. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll proceed through the slide deck. As you noted, we have a number of slides, a number of different topics, and I'm sure we can get through it very quickly.
Yes, and we'll have a couple of pauses along the way, so if we could try to time this slides for an hour and 15 minutes, something like that, that'll give us a little bit of time.
So just as a reminder of where we got started back in 1969 when we did the first lease sales. The state of Alaska was celebrating its 10-year anniversary as a state. We received over $900 million in the Prudhoe lease sales that year, and the FY70 state budget was all of $173 million. In 1976, the voters approved the constitutional amendment creating the permanent fund. There was a sense that this non-renewable resource needed to be saved for future generations, and that the way to do it was to set aside a percentage of the royalty revenues. We received our first deposit in 1977, and it was $734,000. In 1980, April 8th to be exact, the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation was established to manage and invest the fund. Prior to that time, the fund had been managed by the Department of Revenue staff, and it was intended that the corporation be created to create an independent entity that could manage this fund away from the other state funds. We now have over $66 billion in assets under management. As I previously said, we are getting ready to celebrate 40 years of existence as APFC. Governor Hammond did sign SB 161 into law, and we have become since then an award-winning investment firm that we believe embodies the resiliency, integrity, and the pioneer spirit of Alaska. And we have an influence around the world, and around the world comes to us. And I think one of the things you're going to hear as a theme is how we bring the global economy to Alaska. We are now generating tremendous revenue for the state of Alaska. Our mission is quite simple, and this is in statute when APFC was created 40 years ago, to manage and invest the assets of the fund and other funds designated by law. Members may remember that we also manage on behalf of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority a portion of their funds. Our vision for ourselves is to deliver those sustained, compelling investment returns to benefit current and future generations of Alaskans. And our three values are, first and foremost, integrity, stewardship, and passion. We recognize the responsibility that Alaska has given us, and that our success depends on being good stewards of the fund and having the trust of Alaskans. Just to highlight just how important the fund has become to the state of Alaska in recent years, this is from the fall revenues forecast from 2015 to 2019. And you can see that the permanent fund now is providing in excess of petroleum and non-petroleum revenue. And so we are the number one source of revenue for the state. No matter how it is used, it is that revenue source.
We have a question from Senator Von Imhoff.
I just want to clarify, the light blue is investment income. So that's the efforts of your staff investing the fund worldwide, and that's the income they receive. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, that is correct, and that is the POMV calculation right there. So that doesn't include all of the other things that we do in addition to the POMV calculation. This is just that contribution.
And that, for those watching at home, is a percent of market value. You want to briefly define that for those watching at home that aren't familiar with the acronyms that we throw around the table with ease?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, POMV, as you'll see on slide 7, is a percent of market value. So we calculate the average market value of the total fund. This is the principal plus the earnings reserve account. And we take the average of 5 of the preceding fiscal years, and we average that out, and then we take a percent of that market value for and make that available for appropriation. So you'll see in FY19, it was approximately $2.7 billion. For FY21, it is $3.1 billion. This calculation has a one-year lag in it, so this calculation was known when we closed the books on fiscal year 19 for FY21. So we're in the middle of FY20, just so people understand the time frames. This will step down to a 5% starting with FY22, and our forecast for the next 3 years of what that draw would look like for the next 3 years is also found on slide 7.
Did we have a question? I thought I saw someone's hand moving when I put Senator Bishop.
I just wanted to make a comment back on just briefly on page 6 is the POMV earnings at 3091. You know, we did better than ExxonMobil did year over year on profit.
Go ahead and continue.
The Permanent Fund Corporation's investment responsibilities are found in statute, and about 15 years ago, the statute was amended to put in place what we call the prudent investor. And the language you see in that first bullet point is directly from the statute, so that we will exercise the judgment and care that an institutional investor of ordinary prudence exercises. And I think it's important to note that we will not speculate, but in regard to the permanent disposition of funds, we'll consider the preservation of the purchasing power of the fund over time. This recognizes the need to build on that inflation-adjusted, risk-adjusted, and maximize the expected total return from both income and from the appreciation of capital. We do not and are not allowed to borrow money or guarantee the principal from the principal of the fund the obligations of others. We can do standalone investment vehicles. For example, in real estate, we can borrow against a specific property and pledge that property, but we can't pledge the value of the entire fund. And then we are also required to maintain a reasonable diversification among those investments. If you look historically over the last 40 years, you'll see how the asset allocation has changed. And this has changed for a variety of reasons. Markets have changed considerably. The comfort level with taking on different market risks has changed. And I think what this has done is it recognizes the ability of the corporation to invest around the world, tap into growing economies around the world, including the U.S. economy in the lower 48, and bring those returns back to Alaska and deploy those returns into the state of Alaska. So in the past, when we talk about the revenue and thinking back to that slide with the petroleum revenue versus the permanent fund use, if you think about it, at one point we were highly dependent on oil and what the North Slope was doing and what Alaska's economy was doing. And in this case, we now have probably one of the most diverse sets of revenue of any state in the United States in the sense of exposure to economies that are not the local state economy. In 2019, you'll see that diversification of assets that have come about, and we have what we believe is a resilient asset allocation that can withstand a lot of different volatilities within the market. We organize our asset allocation around both growth and income. So to think about growth and the type of assets that we invest in that would be considered growth assets, this is most commonly known as public equities. We also invest in more illiquid growth assets such as private equity. On the income side, we also have fixed income, which is our bond portfolios, and then we have illiquid income producing assets by directly investing in both real estate and infrastructure. The Board of Trustees do review the asset allocation annually. They've been working on this project now, this current board, over the course of the year. We will be talking about asset allocation and making a proposal in February that they will adopt in May to begin July 1st. And that will be a five-year plan because it's time to adjust a longer-term asset allocation and then just review it internally or review it annually to make any adjustments around that more broader long-term plan. We have continued to work on building our in-house management. You'll see that over the last year, we've been able to bring more and more internally. This allows us to lower our fees with investment with the benefit of active management by the staff down the street. It allows us to have increased flexibility over timing and tactical decisions when we have in-house management. And quite honestly, it allows us to align the goals of the mandates we have been given for the fund with our investment strategies. Diving a little deeper into that internal management versus external management, we wanted to make sure that we were clear with you on how we define internal management because it can be confusing between the public markets and the private markets. So on the public markets, this is investment staff directly buying and selling publicly traded securities, buying stocks, buying bonds. On the private market side, this is staff directly conducting the investment decision and legal due diligence for a fund or an investment and making that active decision to invest. You'll see probably our largest internal management is in the fixed income. This is 24% of the portfolio today. And that has been the case for the last 40 years. We have traditionally managed bond portfolios in-house, and we have built more and more internal capability across all the asset classes as we've gone as we've grown. As I alluded to earlier, this is always my brag sheet. I like to talk about what an award-winning corporation Alaska has, and that they should be extremely proud of the work that's being done on behalf of them here in Alaska. As I said, Marcus has won a number of awards. You can see his awards. We also got recognized by Private Debt Magazine for their 30 most influential investors in private credit. Our HR manager was accepted to the Forbes Human Resources Council, so it's not just investors, it's also our administrative staff that are winning these and getting these nods of sort of best in class and asking for and being influential in terms of leading discussions. And when we talk about these awards and accomplishments, as many of you are aware, we hosted here in September the annual meeting of the International Forum of Sovereign Wealth Funds. We brought in over 250 people from around the world that lead sovereign wealth funds around the world to talk about best practices, governance structures. And this map is where you can see where we have investments around the world and the effect of that global diversification. And how important what is happening outside of Alaska is to Alaskans, because that money then is coming back and getting put into the Alaska economy. So talking about outcomes, our FY19 performance, so that's the one-year number. The permanent fund is a long-term fund. It is invested in perpetuity. And so many of the strategies that we put in place are not designed to be daily strategies, but rather they're to yield investment returns over business cycles, over a period of time. And so for us, looking at the 3 and 5 year numbers are in many ways more important than what we did in the last fiscal year. You'll see we returned 6.32% for the fiscal year. The three-year return was 9.96%. In order to understand whether or not we can judge these numbers to be good, we have benchmarks that the board has assigned to help us measure our performance. Our first benchmark is the passive index benchmark. This is a very straightforward index. It's comprised of a 60% public equities, 20% bonds, 10% real estate, and 10% treasury inflation-proofed securities. And this would be as if you had a computer just generating your investment portfolio and what it would have returned. You'll see that over the last fiscal year, it would have returned 5.59%. So what this is telling you, the difference between the two, is the contribution made by the staff at APSC and the decision making that was conducted by that staff. And that generated an additional $473 million in FY19 over and above what we could have done without the staff at the corporation. The second is the performance benchmark. Each individual asset class has a benchmark that we use to measure it internally. We weight these according to their weight within the total fund, and we calculate what the performance of that benchmark is, and then we compare it to what we actually did. In this case, the performance benchmark actually exceeded our total fund. So this means in some ways that the active managers that we chose did not do as well, or certain maybe strategic or tactical decisions made did not yield what we expected, what we would have hoped it would have made. And then finally, we have the long-term objective by the board, which is the 5% plus CPI. For FY19, 5% plus CPI was 6.65, so we did not quite hit that benchmark either. You'll notice that for the three-year period, though, we have exceeded all three benchmarks.
Here we have Senator Von Imhoff and then Senator Wilkowski.
I was just going to, thank you, Chair Stittman. I was going to say that to Ms. Riddell, you did exceed all of your benchmarks. Well done. Now that the permanent fund is over 60% of the total revenue for the state, we really appreciate your efforts. Clearly, you have found a good mix of asset allocation as well as investment in-house and outside. So thank you for this, and keep up the good work.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. Just excellent on the 3 and 5 year. What do you attribute the percent and a little bit more under the performance benchmark in FY19? Is there any lessons to be learned, mistakes that were made?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, and I will say for the chair's benefit, this is when I'm tempted to throw out the lifeline just to see if it actually works.
But okay.
I'm going to take an initial stab at this one. And I think when we look at individual class performances, there are a couple of asset classes that, and there, like I said, there were some tactical decisions. We have an overweight in public equities. We have a tilt, I should say, not an overweight, a tilt towards non-U.S. funds. So emerging markets did not do as well, for example. And when you look at the S&P 500 and what it did this past year and the effect of Facebook, Netflix, Google, the FANG stocks, they just really outperform in any way, shape, and form. So if you went away from those stocks, you were not going to do as well. In real estate as well, the real estate portfolio is in the process of being rebuilt after we had a major sale of an asset. And so I think as the staff continue to work through that portfolio, it lags its performance benchmark considerably, but we fully expect that to turn around. It is a focus of both Marcus's and the board's. The board has been spending a lot of time looking into that portfolio.
Follow up?
Yeah, and looks like the private equity has grown pretty substantially from 2006 to 2019. And can you just talk about what sort of investments are being made and what I guess I'm just curious what that involves and how that's different than investing in the stock market, for example.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, you know, private equity is a really interesting space, and it has gained a lot of traction by institutional investors over the last few years. It can run from anything from U.S. insurance companies to European retail. It runs the gamut, and really what it is, I think, is looking for those companies. Private equity is really about finding those companies that are privately held that may have an opportunity to, may need additional capital, may be at a point where they're ready to really scale their operations, and going public isn't necessarily the right avenue for them because for whatever reason. And so this allows us to tap into a market that we would not otherwise have access to because there are a lot of companies that just don't publicly trade. And when you look at the number of listed stocks, it has continued to decline over the last 10 years. There's a lot of speculation as to why that is. And so we want to make sure we have as diverse a portfolio as we can in some of these industries, and this allows us access to that through this mechanism.
Follow up?
Yeah, and then just what sort of returns are you seeing on private equity? And then I guess maybe, I don't know, it might be related or not, but I understand that you adopted a policy last year, I believe, or started investing in Alaskan companies. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about that, how that's working, what sort of investments we're seeing, and what sort of returns we're seeing.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, We did announce the Alaska program. It is a $200 million mandate. We awarded $100 million to Barings and out of the East Coast. They have tremendous experience in building in-state programs across the country. We also awarded $100 million to McKinley Capital. McKinley Capital has tremendous experience understanding the opportunities that are here in Alaska. We have not had any draws on those amounts yet, which means that they're evaluating opportunities. We have and continue to work to keep an arm's length from that. We do not maintain any veto powers in those agreements. We truly want them to be making those investment decisions and see how what they find. My understanding is that they are seeing a lot of interesting things across the state that might surprise Alaskans, because I think when we think of investing in Alaska, we think of a rail line, we think of a pipeline, you know, we think of these major, you know, multi-billion dollar infrastructure projects. And in fact, there is a lot of much smaller, whether it is in the communications space, telecom, some of the alternative energy space, some other types of infrastructure opportunities that might be available. So I know that they are working hard on all of that. And I'm sorry, Senator, through the chair, I don't remember the first part of your question.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It was just on the performance of private equity.
Oh, through the chair, that's correct. We have traditionally gotten in double digits, 12-15% in that range. Hopefully well north of that.
Hey, hold it.
Patty's.
Go ahead and continue with the question.
Through the chair, the question was on private equity, what the returns are on private equity. And so when we look at the 1 year, the 1 year return was 17.6% and the 3 year return was 22.8%. So I was completely understating it, which I am glad staff provided the correction for the committee. So it's an important piece asset allocation for us.
Okay. And if you want to a brief at ease or something to just flag me and I'll watch the folks in the room, and if they start squirreling, I'll stop. Because we want as accurate as possible, and these, for those watching at home, these are not scripted questions. The permanent fund is taking these on the fly, so we could expect questions that come down the table that you know, they haven't thought about me, that they would be asked at the meeting. So this is for those watching at home, this is just a normal process. We do not give them a set of questions to respond to before the meeting. And we also, just for those watching at home, we don't play the gotcha game trying to ask or stump the presenter. What we're trying to do here is get the information to flow out for public dissemination, in this case, on the permanent fund today. So, Senator Wilkowski, you have a follow-up on that?
Yeah, I looking at your historical asset allocation and noticing that there has been a couple new asset classes that are being invested in, and you have them listed as infrastructure and asset allocation. And can you just talk a little bit about those and what sort of performance you're seeing from those?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, and I do want to make a note that we put monthly performance reports on our website, so you can, and people at home can go to our website and look up many of these numbers themselves. Infrastructure is investing in things like ports, toll roads, utility systems. These investments, we have the exposure to these around the world, primarily not as much in the United States as you might expect. More of them are outside the United States. But the infrastructure returns for 1 year were 7.4%, for 3 years, 15.1%, and for 5 years, 16.4%. So they provide regularized income similar to real estate, and that's why we like this asset class. Asset allocation is this interesting bucket we use that sort of is a catch-all for all the other individual asset classes. So this is where we might have to manage some cash. It might be where we need to manage some foreign currency exposure, liquidity exposure. So it's also where we have our risk parity investments. So it has to have an outlook over the total fund versus any specific type of asset. These returns in 1 year for 1 year was 9%, for 3 years it was 2.8%, and for 5 years it was 2.5%. So you can see from those returns sort of what the bond markets were doing and the influence that had on that portfolio during that time.
Okay, so we'll move along and to the next slide, please.
Getting back on track, Mr. Chairman. Just looking how the fund values and returns have grown over time, you will see the growth of the fund since our inception in 1977 to 2019, where we are just under $70 billion. I think what's interesting here is when you look at the bands of individual returns, what this chart is going to show you, and I think this is what's really important as we talk about the POMV and the draws, is we talk a lot about volatility, and you'll see in this chart how returns on an annual basis are all over the place. They 1 year they can be quite high, in 1 year they can be quite low. They have ranged, and we mark this band where they have fallen between 0 and 15% positive. You'll see just that there were between 2000 and 2003, they were negative, and then of course with the Great Financial Crisis in 07, 08, 09 time period. And so we are going to have periods of loss. We're going to have volatility. But over time, we have managed to really grow the fund, and we hope that will continue. In terms of forecasting, we have both a current fiscal year and a 10-year forecast for the projected return of the total of the fund. This is provided to us by Cowen Associates. It's the same capital markets forecast that they use for all our clients, so they do not create a special forecast just for us. It needs to be clear again, I just said it, I'm going to repeat it because of the importance of it, that there will be a wide range of returns delivered by each asset class, and that today Cowen is projecting a total return of 7% over the next 10-year period. So just to recognize that it could be anything but 7% for each of those years, but then when you go back and look at the 10-year time period, the expectation is that it will have returned 7%. They use an inflation rate of 2.25% for that same period, so the real return of the portfolio is expected to be 4.75%.
You have a question?
At the individual...
Hold a second. I thought we had a question from Senator Bishop, but we have one from Senator Wilikowski on slide 20.
I'm not really sure where this fits in, but I'm just curious, has the Permanent Fund Corporation changed their investing philosophy in light of the fact that the government is now using a fairly significant amount of the earnings reserve? Are you tending to invest a little bit more conservatively now?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, no. We have not changed our investment strategy. It is a topic of it is a constant topic. It has been a topic at, I would say, the last three board meetings. It will be a topic at this board meeting in February because the Board of Trustees is really focused on that. Both the Chief Investment Marcus and Sebastian have done a tremendous amount of work trying to help inform the board on taking risk-adjusted returns, where to take that. Approximately $49 billion, at the end of the fiscal year, $49 billion will be in the corpus of the fund, and that needs to be invested in perpetuity. And so trying to balance that long-term requirement with the short-term need, the yearly annual needs of the state is what the board is wrestling with.
I think we're going to continue on with Senator Bilikowski's questions later in the presentation. That is a more focal point towards the end, is why I'm trying to make sure we get to the end to have that discussion, because there's other things related to that. So go ahead and continue.
On slide 21, you see the individual asset class expected returns for 10 years. And I think one of the interesting things to note on this is that no single asset class is expected to return double digits now over the next 10-year period. For those, the annualized standard deviation, this is the difference around which the returns can happen. So when I'm going to take an easy math one, the cash equivalents, so 2.5%, it's only expected to vary plus or minus 0.9%, so 3.4 versus 1.6% would be the range of outcomes. That's what the standard deviation is telling you on this chart. Looking from FY20, and this is from our history and projections that can be found on our website, we have a low expected return of negative 0.52%. When you add the effect of inflation to that, we would have a total return of minus 2.05%. We tend to use the mid, 6.61%. With that inflation, the real return would be just slightly over 5%. For the 10-year period, you'll see the 7%. It just happens to be coincidence this year, in effect of the math, that both the total return and the statutory return are the same. Normally, this is not the case, and you can kind of see that in the low, mid, and high cases for FY20, how those can vary. We are projected to have a balance of $84.6 billion by the end of FY29. This assumes that 7% total return happens over the next 10 years, and that there is a strict adherence to all the rules, such as royalty deposits at both the constitutional minimum of 25% and the statutory 50% for leases entered into after 1979, that we continue to inflation-proof the fund, and that the legislature sticks with the POMV rules of not exceeding the percent of market value.
So I think the committee has been very interested in following those guidelines as far as the royalty contributions go. We've had that discussion here table last year, because there were some years that only the 25% constitutional obligation was met, not the statutory obligation of the newer leases up to 50%. So that seems to be the vast support of the members of the committee, that we follow not only the constitutional requirement, which is a floor, but we follow the statutory 50%. So I think we're synced up on that. Inflation proofing, we will probably discuss that a little bit later too, but the committee has been very supportive of making sure that the inflation proof dollars are in there. And the percent of market value maximum draw of 5.25% that is for last year and this year is not breached. And going forward, the 5% is also not breached. So that goes to Senator Bilikowski's earlier question, I think, about action at this table or into the legislature that would put the permanent fund in a position to adjust their asset allocation and their time horizons or what have you, their structure, to respond to potential ad hoc draws. So the committee is very sensitive to that issue also. So I just thought I'd mention that to bring in Senator Wilikowski's earlier question, because it's a point that you know, we don't want to gloss over. Go ahead and continue.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this page. This is found on our website. This is our history and projections with actuals through December 31st, 2019. We include on this, there's a lot of information on here, and we include in here both the actual POMV calculations for both FY20 and FY21 so that you can see what the balances are that are being used to do those calculations and what those statutory distributions would be.
Okay, but before we go on, I thought we'd talk about this one a little bit, even though it's a very busy slide. It's on your website, updated, I think, monthly, so the public can pull it up and follow it along. But we have last year, we added $4 billion to the corpus with support of the committee. And actually, the Finance Committee wanted a little more than that. We also had language in there to ensure that that money, that contribution into the corpus, which is the constitutionally protected side, is forward inflation proofing, to ensure that the forward inflation proofing until that's used up is taking place. That was just one step. So I'd like to have a little bit of conversation from your thoughts on the buildup of the earnings reserve, because there is interest from the committee members to do another contribution into the earnings, or from the earnings reserve to the corpus, to protect it from the legislative appropriations as the pressure continues to build dealing with our budgets. And I see here that you're, maybe I'll have you kind of run through what the permanent fund as of December 31st feels the earnings reserve balance looks like going forward the next 2 or 3 years. If you could help us with that, and then we'll continue on the discussion.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. So you'll see in the yellow bars highlighted in the middle, that is the current fiscal year, FY20. And we show those low, mid, and high cases, which were those rates of returns I discussed on the previous slide. What that generates potentially, and we'll just take the mid case for the purposes of this discussion, is that we expect currently, all things being equal, no major market hiccups, that by the end of the fiscal year, so on June 30th, 2020, we would have a balance in the principal of the fund of approximately $53.4 billion. So that is between the combinations of special appropriations, inflation proofing, and all the royalty revenue we've received. That is the amount that is not available for spend. It does include, and it's important to note, it includes $6.8 billion in unrealized gain. That unrealized gain sits in this principal account until such time we go to sell that asset and we actually cash in that gain. When we cash that gain in, the gain moves over to the earnings reserve account and the cost of the investment stays behind in the principal of the account, principal of the fund. Moving over to the right, we then develop all the income, the distribution. So you'll see the POMV going out of $2.9 billion. You see the special appropriation, which will come in at the end of fiscal year 20 because of the way the statutory language works for those movements back in. And then what we would have an ending balance of money available for appropriation of $12.5 billion. So after we've taken care of all the things we need to take care of this year, there would be an additional $12.5 billion. That has associated with it
a little over $1.8 million in additional unrealized gains for a total balance in the earnings reserve account projected to be $14.3 billion at the end of the fiscal year. So then when we look at FY21, you'll see that the $3 billion comes out for the FY21 POMV draw. And then the expected POMV draws based on that 7% straight line growth over the next 10 years.
And we'll come back to that contribution in a couple of slides. But I think this is, for those watching at home, this is a very good history to pull up from time to time if you're interested in the permanent fund performance, because it's continually updated.
So I spoke a little bit about the structure of the fund in walking through that slide. And just as a reminder, the constitutional language is very simple, straightforward, clear. It just requires that 25%, at least 25% of these royalties be deposited. All income from the permanent fund shall be deposited in the general fund. We are only allowed to use the principal for income-producing investments specifically designated by law. We consider this a renewable resource. I think every year we try to create a graphic to try and show how these funds are working interactively with each other and how money moves through the fund. I like this one better than some of the previous ones. It feels more intuitive to me, but you'll see money comes in. It's invested. There's unrealized gains associated with the principal. Money moves into the earnings reserve account. It's those gains when we sell. It's the regular dividend rentals that we get off of real estate. We pay for our expenses at the corporation. We pay the percent of market value, and then we reinvest whatever is left behind.
We have a question from Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So, Ms. Riddell, I see the separate smaller circle for the earnings reserve account. Do you know of any other fund in the U.S. and the world that has a separate earnings reserve account utilized for draws? It seems to be the ERA is unique to the Alaska Permanent Fund. Is that the case?
Through the chair, that is the case. That is a very unique feature, and it goes back to how the constitutional language was written.
Follow-up question?
Sure, Paul.
So generally then, most endowments, foundations, sovereign wealth funds have just one large fund that they manage as a whole and then manage their assets to provide the funding throughout the year for their 5% draw.
Through the chair, that is correct. Most trusts and most endowments, trusts, have just one pool of money with a prudent spend limit on it. They use that as their percent of market value. We call it our percent of market value, and that's the distribution, and there is no opportunity to affect change on that.
If I could just add, just and then I'll let you continue. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Fund, I do not think has an earnings reserve component, and they do 4.25% of market value. So go ahead and continue.
Last question. Thank you, Chair Stedman. So by, I think you alluded to it, by having one whole fund, it's protected in essence as a corpus. With an earnings reserve account, there's, well, you saw previous slide, $14 billion plus in potential vulnerability, if you will, to be accessed, thereby taking, you know, maybe a quarter of the fund pretty quickly if we were to take the whole thing. By having the earnings reserve account similar, folded into the full corpus similarly to all other endowments and foundations and sovereign wealth funds across the country and in the world, we would be protecting the corpus. It's just another added layer of protecting the corpus and the fund over time.
Through the chair, that is correct. As I said, the challenge with the earnings reserve account is that that's a unique feature due to the constitutional language. So that has always been the challenge for the permanent fund.
Thank you.
Okay. And therein lies the conflicting statutes that we struggle with the statutory dividend versus the maximum draw, the percent of market value that we're going to be working through this year and maybe even longer until we get a result. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, and maybe to sort of close the loop on that, do you think your job would be made easier, the Permanent Fund Corporation's job would be maybe made easier, if the earnings reserve were folded in via constitutional amendment into just one giant pool of money and you had constitutional provisions for the dividend, let's say, and for perhaps a valve for government as well?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, the board has, I don't know that it would make our job easier. Our job is to invest the fund. That's what we do. So that's what we are focused on. For us, the challenge comes with trying to understand and reconcile our investment strategies with the intent of the earnings reserve account. To the extent it's one fund and we're not having to bifurcate between the two, I think that makes our job cleaner. And the board has been very clear since 2000 that it supports a POMV style fund, rolling the earnings reserve, having a true sort of one fund and eliminating this concept of income versus the rest of the fund. What that looks like at the end of the day, it doesn't affect our work, but having one fund would, from an investment strategy point, which is what we're required to do, would make it cleaner.
Okay. We'll call up Senator Von Imhoff.
Just to add on to Senator Wilikowski's comment, I would venture that based on hearing recommendations coming from the board in the past, the board, I would suspect, is more interested in just the draw from the fund, the amount of the draw, whether it's 5.25, more ad hoc draws, less, versus what the legislature does with the money, whether we spend it all on a dividend, some on the dividend. I think that's the issue that, based on what I've read in the past, is you will manage the fund based, or you'll manage the draw amount based on what the legislature asks and how we spend it. It's up to us.
Through the chair, that is correct. And it reduces, appropriation risk with inflation proofing, with royalty. It does a lot of things to just create that one fund. And I think that's the intent of the trustees, is to really build a robust asset that is available for all generations of Alaskans.
Okay. We'll continue.
One of the things that I wanted to make a point of, because this occurred last year, I think it's the first time, not the first time, it is probably the largest deposit that has been made by a state to future generations. It well exceeds anything that previous legislatures in this state have done. You'll see how royalties have fluctuated over the years. You'll also see the contributions by inflation proofing. In 2010, inflation was flat, so there was no inflation proofing. In 16, 17, and 18, there was no appropriation for inflation proofing. So you see that large contribution that you all made, and I just wanna, on behalf of Alaskans, thank the legislature and governor for making that contribution to our.
We have a symbolic presentation. If my co-chair would grab that check and bring it down to the end of the table, please. No, down to the permanent fund. For $4,943 million, the largest contribution to the principal portion of the permanent fund in the history of the state. And most likely, as stated earlier, the largest contribution to any endowment fund or structures anywhere similar to this in the United States, and quite frankly, maybe the planet. We're not sure. We got to rectify that, or that last comment, or check it. But it is significant, and we thought we would honor the permanent fund with this symbolic check to be kept in the Capitol for display for future generations of Alaskans, so they may look forward decades from now and see the value of compound interest, the ninth wonder of the world. That is going to be a significant pile of money, to put it bluntly.
The largest amount, but it's the largest check. Yeah.
So we have to beat the drum once in a while on good things. We spend a lot of time at this table struggling with problematic issues. And
you know, Mr. Chairman, you do struggle with problematic issues, and there's been tremendous debate the last 4 years. I mean, you see it in the 16, 17, 18 numbers there about just how challenging it has been, and to stop for a moment and all come together, because we all agree that the future generations need to be taken care of, has to be commended. Mm-hmm. And I applaud each and every one of you.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Just also as a footnote, I always like to point it out that even though the 16, 17, 18 years, and then it was caught up, right? There was no money, then it was caught up. I just want to give credit to where credit's due to the legislature. They've put $7 billion above and beyond, notwithstanding the $4 billion transfer that was done last year in this fund. Yes. That's and a little gone footnote that the public doesn't never see.
And we have also not drawn out historically the 50% portion that's been going to the dividends. We've been reinvesting at the state's portion over time. It's a little nuance, but it made a significant difference in the value today of the permanent fund. We have been also joined in the audience by Senator Reinbold. The record reflect that. But if you could continue on then to slide 29, and I'd like to have a little discussion on this slide also.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. This shows the breakout for FY20, where we stand as of December 31st, which is the last quarter financials we have available. So you'll see in the principal we have contributions of $41.7 billion with unrealized gains associated of $7.3 billion. In the earnings reserve account, there is $7.5 billion in realized earnings. This is amounts available for appropriation. Unrealized gain of an additional $2.7 billion. We have set aside and reserved $3.1 billion for the FY21 percent of market value. We have reserved and set aside the $4 billion contribution to principal, and that is, as I said before, that has to come at the end of the fiscal year, which is why you don't see it in the principal today or on December 31st. And then we mark inflation proofing based on actual inflation. The budget includes an estimation, so this is what its actual inflation is showing. It's going to be closer to something like $600,000. $600 million, not $600,000.
So there's a lot of concern at the finance table here that the appropriation limit on the permanent fund gets breached. And when that happens, we call it an ad hoc draw, but it could snowball and make it just like the life cycle of the Constitutional Budget Reserve. We could eradicate billions over a handful of years rather than make hard decisions. So I'd like to ask the permanent fund to help the committee in reviewing the earnings reserve, because we want to have a discussion towards the end of the session on an additional contribution to the constitutionally protected portion. I recognize that this has been discussed. The size of the earnings reserve has been discussed at the board, permanent fund board. My concern is they are not taking into account politics, just portfolio mathematics. And by that, what I mean is they may feel that the permanent fund should carry a larger earnings reserve than the finance committee. And the concern there is the larger the earnings reserve, the bigger the juicy cash target is in the middle of the table. And this juicy cash target could get immense over the next few years. And it is easy for us to access it if we so choose. And for those, again, watching at home, just a few years ago, one of the political parties wanted to access $10 million, or excuse me, $10 billion of their interest reserve. The following year, the other political party wanted to take $10 billion. So the issue is not one political group versus another political group, or an urban group versus a rural group. It is just the easiest, juiciest target for an immediate fix of a shorter-term budget challenge. And we are most likely going to conclude that a smaller yet still prudent earnings reserve that would give us the dividend funds and the other draw, the total draw, if it's 5% or what have you, going forward. So we're not interested in crippling the ability of the permanent fund to facilitate its cash flow to the general fund of the state. But we are definitely concerned of the easy access the appropriators have. And as an example, for those watching at home, how easy it is, on an appropriation bill, we can take an operating budget bill or the capital budget bill, doesn't matter, but we'll use the operating budget bill. One body takes action, sends it to the other body, and that body takes action on the bill itself. The body in possession of it at the end could easily add any number they want out of the earnings reserve, put it in the document, get a majority votes on the floor, 21 on the House or 11 in the Senate. The other body just has to concur, agree with it, put it on the governor's desk, he signs it, money's gone. It's gone for all the future generations in perpetuity, as you mentioned earlier, for the state of Alaska. So it is a very easy political maneuver and very, very dangerous to the permanent fund. So until such time as the earnings reserve is rolled in to the corpus and we change the Constitution, as referenced earlier by Co-Chair Von Imhoff, we need to be very guarded of the permanent fund, because it would be easier to extract an ad hoc draw than it is going to be to deal with the problematic challenges within the operating budget that we're struggling with. And the public has seen that the last couple of weeks and will be a glaring example starting Monday through the end of Friday next week. So that is why I thought I would pause here on this slide, because of the concern that I have and other members have, that the permanent fund board, it's not a political board, but our view of the earnings reserve size is probably going to be a little different and more defensive for that reason. And we'll be working with the permanent fund as we go forward on estimates on the contribution amount. And I thought, because last year was $4 billion, we would just use $4 billion as a plug number, and we would do some analysis around that. But I would be very surprised if the Finance Committee at the end of this session does not have some contribution to the earnings reserve of the permanent fund for that very reason. Again, it's up to the committee members, and we'll have those discussions and collectively make a decision, and then also the full Senate and the full House to put the item on the governor's desk. And the governor might take a position on it also. It's up to him. But we are the appropriators, and we're responsible to protect that permanent fund for future generations. And we fully intend to do it here. Senator Von Imhoff and Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Stedman. So I'm just to kind of build a little bit on that concept. You have the light blue 3.1 for FY21 as the POMV. Now, it's my understanding that the POMV, the draw of the cash, goes to the general fund on a periodic basis. Right now, we're looking at the CBR at about $2 billion. We're going to be having a supplemental next week that's got a big price tag on it that may be drawing down that CBR a little bit. Has there been any conversations between the permanent fund and the folks managing the general fund to change the cadence of the frequency of the POMV, meaning has there been a need for cash sooner than what was sooner than the schedule?
Through the chair, Senator Von Himhoff, we do work closely with Treasury Division at Department of Revenue, and for anybody, for your staffs, for anybody listening, Department of Revenue, Treasury Division does have on their website all of the cash draws. So you can see money coming from the CBR, money coming from the earnings reserve account as needed. So you can track this with them as they do this. The first year, FY19, we had a schedule. Their cash flow didn't require, we actually ended up delaying considerably the draws. So in other words, we started off with a very simple quarterly schedule because we hadn't done this. Neither side had done this. And then as we went along, and let's take the dividend out of this discussion for this discussion purposes, because it sort of it stands on its own. And we have with the agreement that they can either accelerate it or decelerate it. And in FY19, they actually decelerated it. And so we made a large transfer on June 30th, on the last day of the fiscal year, because that money has to move over. It doesn't fall back to the earnings reserve account if it's not used. In FY20, we're seeing just the opposite. So we're seeing more of an acceleration of the use of that money versus what happened in 19. You would have to talk with Treasury about why that is, what's happening there. They have used roughly $2.4 billion of the $2.9 billion for FY20 thus far through the year. So there is cash management going on, and they are working diligently to manage through that. So that's what I know about that today. I don't have any sense of why that is.
I think what the committee should consider doing is having a conversation with Treasury, because the proposed budget in front of us would take the balance of the savings account from $2 billion possibly to around $500 million, depending on supplementals or and performance, but a significant erosion of its value. So if they are either tight or have already made some modifications to the cash management, I would imagine it would be amplified substantially if the balance goes to 500 million. So Senator Von Imhoff, I think that's a very good point. At some point we should have Treasury come in and we'll continue this conversation on the cash flow, which we've worked at the table quite a bit. It is very on point and pertinent to the cash flow management of the state that we've been concerned about as we work through this difficulty.
And Mr. Chairman, I just want to make it clear for the record that $2.4 billion includes $1 billion payout for the dividend in October. Right. So just to be clear that that's not just for state services.
Right. No, yeah. No, I understand that. We're looking at it in the entirety. And that's the way we look at it at the table, too. And we let Treasury and Permanent Fund work out the logistics. We work at a higher level. We just want to make sure if there's a big bump or difficulty coming, if we draw down their savings account to 500 million or a billion, we'd like to know about it when we set the policy forward off from the table. Senator Von Imhoff.
Just the last comment is that the CBR, our state savings account, is meant to be a short-term, daily type of revenue source, revenue payback. The ERA is long-term, like we've talked about this whole presentation and how it's invested. We don't want the ERA to become the short-term cushion for the general fund. That is the CBR's job, because that's it's invested entirely different. If the ERA becomes a short term, those investment numbers that we saw earlier could potentially go down because you're going to invest it more for the prudent investor in more of a short term fixed income type of assets. So we just want to be aware that the CBR needs to have a robust enough balance to provide the necessary daily cash flow in a short-term basis, daily, weekly, that the general fund needs, because that's not the earnings reserve account's role.
And I'd like to just add a little bit of that. We saw that take place in the CBR, when the CBR had plus $10 billion in it. It was broken into two components. One component was managed more aggressively than the rest of it. And as the CBR balance came down, we all saw it here at the table. The time horizon comes in, returns come down, and we don't want to have that impact on the permanent fund. So that's another reason why we want to be very careful on our draw rate of the permanent fund. We have about 15 minutes left, or a little less than that, about 10 slides, so if we can go on to slide 30. I think there's no other questions on the table. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. And just I just want to say I share the Chair Stedman's concerns about the ease of access with which the legislature has to the earnings reserve. I've said that for many years. What is the minimum balance in the earnings reserve that you believe we need? That's question number one. And question number two is, do you believe the Permanent Fund Corporation would be violating its prudent investor obligation if it were forced to sell assets to provide funds for government or to pay a dividend for that matter?
I think the first part of that question, let's postpone that minimum balance discussion for later in the session because that comes to the contribution amount. We're going to have a robust discussion on that. We may or may not agree with the Board of Trustees in the size of that. So let's not put her on the spot on that. Let's get some time, give some time for some analysis and options on that subject. But second half of this question, could you help Senator Wilkowski with that?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, and through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski. I do not believe it is a violation of fiduciary responsibility to meet the obligations that are expected of the fund. And so where the prudency comes in is going through the investment portfolio, understanding where the unrealized gains are potentially, and what the most prudent course of action is to meet the obligation that we have been asked to deliver on. So I think it's not at all a violation of our fiduciary duty. I think where it gets hard is just when we make investment decisions, and if we make a commitment to a private equity fund and it's expected to be there 5, 7, 12 years, and now we're required to come up with something in a year, maybe it's not prudent to be in a 7 or 12 year investment anymore. And that's the challenge that we're wrestling with.
So we have about 10 slides and about 10 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe most of these slides I can get through fairly quickly. Just to give Alaskans and the committee a sense of the return on the investment that they have made with the corporation, we generated in FY19 $3.9 billion in revenue. Our operating and investment expenses was approximately $132.6 million. This is external fees, operational allocation. We generated, that means there were 251 active trading days in fiscal year 2019. So we were generating approximately $15.6 million in revenue per day, and we generated approximately $13 million in statutory net income. We are the revenue generator now for the state of Alaska. That POMV draw, as you can see, it went from 42% to 52% in the FY21 proposed budget. There continues to be increased reliance on corporate activity, so all of the things we do, as I said earlier, we have one mission. It's to invest the funds entrusted to us. What is the reliance on that activity? Well, for FY20, we're delivering $2.9 billion to the state. We're inflation-proofing the principal. It was forecasted in that budget to be $943 million. You approved an operations budget of $17.8 million. You'll notice that there is a slight decrement to that in the FY21 governor's proposed budget. We have investment management fees. We expected to need about $150.4 million. That has a significant decrement down to $129.4 million due to the elimination of a strategy that staff recommended and the board concurred no longer made sense for the fund. It required about $17 million investment management fees. Those assets have been redistributed across a number of different asset allocations. We also contribute to the Department of Law's budget. In addition to what they get through the $2.9 billion, we have a set aside an agreement of equal to about $2.6 million for the collection of royalties. Similar with the Department of Natural Resources, $6.1 million. And then we pay some administrative fees for the Department of Revenue. So there is a tremendous amount of support that we need in order to support all of you. I just want to touch on the board briefly. We've talked about it periodically through this meeting. But just as a reminder, the trustees have a duty to Alaskans to ensure that the permanent fund is managed and invested in that prudent investor with that rule. This means, and there were three legislative findings that the legislature made at the time of creating the corporation, and that the fund should provide a means of conserving a portion of revenue to benefit all generations of Alaskans, that we should maintain safety of principal while maximizing total return, and that we should be provide a savings device managed to allow maximum use of disposable income. The board issued in 2018 its resolution 1804, and just as a reminder to the committee that following sort of having these rules-based withdrawals for the fund helps ensure the long-term sustainability of using those earnings. This resolution was passed at a special meeting on October 17th, and it affirms the importance of using those formulas and identified four key principles. The adherence to it creates sustainability, the inflation proofing, and creating real growth in the fund. I also note that staff and for your benefit, members of the committee, trustee paper number 9, this is also available electronically on our website. This was to talk about how sovereign wealth funds evolve over time and with different uses. We have a robust system of saving and a long track record, but there are still lessons we can learn from our peers around the world. And it identified 5 specific lessons for Alaska: mission clarity, the importance of those rules, enforcement, designing a spending rule, and reforming the earnings reserve account. The board adopted this in December. They also adopted a 5-year strategic plan. The priorities for the next 5 years will be to continue to position the organization and the fund for that annual POMV draw, and to continue to refine our efforts on that, develop a comprehensive risk management program, integrate best-in-class investment management capability, and to continue to enhance that in-house talent and staff throughout APFC. And finally, our budget recognizes the evolution of our role. I think one of the things that's really important to note for the committee, and we'll talk, I know, at a later time about our budget specifically before this body, but just as a reminder, we build our budget from the ground up, so we start at zero every single year and build that budget. So we have merit and retention adjustments, a new position, and then you'll see those operational efficiencies and the decrements in investment management fees. And I think that really demonstrates how efficient we are with the money we're entrusted with. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer any additional questions the members might have.
Do we have any quick questions for the permanent fund? Okay. Seeing none, I'd like to thank you guys for coming. When we're done, displaying the check. We'll decide where we're going to put it. I think it'd be a nice symbolic item hanging somewhere. It's rather large, but that's okay. We'll work it out. Monday, when we reconvene at 9 a.m., I will not be here. Co-chair Von Imhoff, who's in charge of the legislation, and the bill before the committee will be motor fuel tax, and there'll be other items posted on basis. We will have the supplemental budget presentation on Thursday and a few other items throughout the week. So we'll be very busy, so I'll see the committee members again on Tuesday. And I would like to thank the permanent fund for coming today. And we are adjourned.